Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Beryl-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Beryl, and today our guest is Ben Ford, partner in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Beryl. And today we are discussing the recent White House executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. Welcome, Ben. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, Tawny, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
So, Ben, you've been a guest on the show before, but for our new listeners, can you provide a little bit of information about yourself and your practice and why you're here talking about this executive order?
Absolutely. Well, I'm an attorney. I'm a partner in Beryl's Labor and Employment Group. My job is really to advise my clients on all things related to labor and employment law. I have a particular specialty in defending cases that are being litigated in court. And so I find myself arguing motions and sometimes trials when my clients are being accused of discrimination or other forms of violations of the various labor laws. And then I also do a lot of work in advising companies now that we're dealing with a pandemic. We do a lot of work in advising companies in how to manage their labor processes, how to support their payrolls through the various government aid programs. And so it's becoming a very diverse practice.
So Ben, in addition to the advising and the litigating you do, you and I work together. So I know one of the other things that you regularly do is you provide organizations with training and guidance on best practices with regards to creating a work environment that's free from discrimination and harassment. Can you provide our listeners with some background about some of the trainings you may provide generally, which I think are going to come up and be a big portion of our discussion today surrounding this executive order?
Sure. You know, it's interesting. If you look back over the years, Tawny, you know, when we first started doing this, we were really talking about, you know, sexual harassment and the things that employees can and cannot do and say to each other in the workplace. And it was really simple. But we were also noticing that sometimes the trainings we were doing weren't really landing. And so we evolved that message from, yes, we're talking about sexual harassment, but then we're also talking about ways that we can deal with our differences and our diversity in the workforce. So, you know, ways that men and women can work together to create a more professional work environment. So it really has evolved from, you know, no, 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 tisk, 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 to here's some things that you can do to actually create a positive and professional work environment that's more welcoming to a more diverse workforce. And the critical element of that was always trying to teach empathy or trying to get people to see their work environment through the eyes of somebody in a different situation. And so that's really how things have sort of evolved up to this point.
I think that those are really good points, and I never really thought about it that way. But for decades, I mean, our trainings have always been don't, you can't, you mustn't. If you do, you'll get slapped on the wrist and maybe even fired. And I'd say in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a significant evolution in which we're focusing more on what you can do, what you can do in order both to create an environment that is less likely to see claims of harassment or discrimination based off of gender, sex, national origin, race, you know, every protected class that one could think of, and also still meeting any state requirements for the provision of these trainings, which we've seen increase significantly over the course of the last 5 years, both states that are requiring these types of trainings and then the specificity of what must be included in those trainings.
Yeah, and it's evolved. I mean, if you just follow the state training requirements, you know, you're going to end up with a list of things like, well, you can't tell dirty jokes and you can't use swear words and you can't, you know, do this and that. And we found that those trainings were totally ineffective and in some ways actually made the problem worse because we highlighted it and turned a naughty behavior into something prohibited, which of course, if you take any person, you tell them they can't do something naughty, they're going to want to do it. So instead, what we evolved in is saying, here's why you shouldn't do that. Here's how that joke lands on the ears of somebody who's not you. And I think, you know, we were able to actually make a lot of progress in getting people to understand not only that they can't tell the dirty joke, but also why and how that sounds and how the effect that has on the environment.
I remember early in my practice, I would get so upset when the opposing side wouldn't see things from the same perspective or the same point of view as I would. And a senior attorney said to me, you can't deny a person's perception. And in multiple situations when we're dealing with harassment and discrimination, it may not be that one person is lying or purposefully telling a statement that is not the truth, but their perception of a circumstance or situation was different than the other people involved. And I think as we have that discussion, and we're going to circle back around on that during the course of this show, but understanding the way people's minds work has very quickly become a big part of those trainings that we're providing when we're talking about perception versus intention, and how different statements and potentially jokes land with other people. Understanding how the brain works, and while we're not psychologists, becomes a big part of human resources and labor and employment law.
Yes, indeed.
So that brings us to something that may to listeners seem completely unrelated, but I promise we're going to tie it all back together.
It all comes in.
It does. The White House recently issued in late September an executive order that's entitled Combating Race and Sex Stereotyping. Seems like a really important thing, but maybe overlaps some with Title VII. Can you provide some background on what the stated purpose of that executive order is?
So we weren't the only ones evolving our training and our practice into sort of building in a program to teach empathy and to teach things like topics like implicit bias and things like that. There were other people around the country teaching the same thing, but going maybe a little bit further. And I think that what you saw as a result of a lot of the police shootings and the Black Lives Matter movement was you saw a lot of companies instituting racial sensitivity training. And in the process of trying to teach the idea of implicit bias and things like systemic discrimination, we became that message got sort of broadcast, but then received by other people as saying that all white people are inherently racist and therefore bad, or all men are inherently sexist and therefore bad, or you know. And so instead of the message going out as, you know, here's how to look at your sort of white privilege and here's how other people don't have that, it became white privilege means a negative stereotype or a negative behavior. And of course, that was a big hot political issue. And so it ended up on the president's desk. And so that's what this order was designed to address.
So within the orders kind of opening, there's discussion by the White House concerning the pushing of all these different views. And it's interesting because there's this significant focus on historical leaders within our country, both individuals, founding fathers, and also leaders in the Black community. And the executive order itself talks about the fact that the vision of America is not grounded in hierarchies based on collective social and political identities, but equality and dignity. And I think one of the interesting things is when we really start to talk about why these trainings were occurring and what the intention was, right? It's not even close to kind of what the stated purpose ended up being. So we see this conflation almost of ideas. And as we go through and talk about the different definitions within the executive order itself and the actions that have been taken in the approximately, 3 weeks since this order was issued, I think we learn a lot more about what the future of implicit bias and other forms of discrimination trainings may need to look like in order to make sure that federal contractors themselves are able to maintain government contracts. So the purpose, though, of the executive order, right? It applies to any individual or any organization that is performing a contract with the federal government. Is that correct?
Yes. And so it's geared towards the federal workplace. So if you work for the federal government, but also if you work under federal contracts, and that's really, the president's power to govern without any legislative assistance is limited really to these executive orders. And so really only applies in these federal type of workforces. But of course, the federal government and all the federal contractors are the largest employer in the world. And so we're talking about a lot of people here. And we're also talking about, when that many people have to move in one direction, it tends to bring everybody else along with it. The other thing that I'll add really quick, Tani, is that, as we go through this discussion, the language in the executive order is, I would call it inflammatory. And I would say that it's easy to get lost in the inflammatory language. It uses words like, this ideology is rooted in the pernicious and false belief that America is an irredeemably racist and sexist country. That's the kind of thing that you probably hear on a, on talk radio program. But it's important that we not get lost in that, because this is an executive order that we have to comply with. And so, and I would urge listeners who are listening to this and trying to figure out this executive order, set aside the inflammatory language and really look at what we need to do to comply with it. That's really our jobs.
So let's take that like one step further, though. I mean, this didn't go through Congress. This isn't a statute. It's not an act. What is an executive order? And do we, in fact, have to follow an executive order?
Well, the answer is generally yes. So the way Barack Obama was famous when he was being stymied by a Republican-controlled legislature, he was famous for saying, "I have a phone and I have a pen." And what that means is that as the president of the United States, he can, and any president, President Trump can, issue executive orders that order the federal government, of which he is the chief executive of, to do certain things, within legislative framework. And of course, those executive orders are constantly challenged in court by people saying you can do this, or this is within the statute, or it's not. But in general, these executive orders are something that carry the weight of law. If you are working within the federal government system, or if you are a federal contractor, and the way it's enforced is not necessarily by you may not necessarily get thrown in jail, you may not necessarily get fined, but if you're a contractor, your contracts could be canceled. So, I mean, for a lot of people, that's their bread and butter. And so this ends up being something that they have to pay attention to very carefully.
So for executive orders, however, does it only last for the life of the president who's in office at the time, or is this like a statute where it's valid until either revoked or otherwise kind of it is found to be unlawful?
Yeah, it would be valid until the next president comes in and either overturns it or amends it, or until a court finds it to be unlawful.
So depending on the outcome of November's election, there's a chance if there were a change in administration in January, that would provide the next president, if it was a different president, to revoke or amend this executive order. Or if we see the same administration, then arguably it would stay in effect unless or until a court found it to be in violation of statutes or rules, correct?
That's exactly right. And you know, it takes an administration, even if there were a change in administration, it would take that administration probably quite a while to get around to reversing it. And sometimes it may not even get reversed. And so this really is something that we're going to be living with for at least the next few months, and, you know, maybe in perpetuity, depending on what happens.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsandME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill. And today our guest is Ben Ford, attorney, partner at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're discussing the recent White House executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. Before the break, Ben and I were discussing generally the types of training that he and a multitude of other HR professionals and attorneys provide to organizations concerning discrimination and harassment and the evolution of those trainings over the course of the last decade. And then tying that into a discussion about the White House's recent executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping, something that I think, you know, on its face sounds like it's a super important thing, but maybe, you know, has some parallels to Title VII and maybe isn't necessary. Ben, let's dig a little deeper so that I can have a better understanding and our listeners can have a better understanding as to why Title VII doesn't already do these things. Like, don't we have these protections against stereotyping based off of Title VII? And I think the best way to do that is let's just start with the definitions within the executive order. It's my understanding that there's some language regarding something known as divisive concepts that's used within the executive order. Can you explain to me how the executive order defines divisive concepts and then how that relates to what the executive order is attempting to do?
Sure. It defines divisive concepts. There's nine divisive concepts. The first one being that, you know, really simple, that one race or sex is inherently superior to another race or sex. And then the second divisive concept is particularly divisive, I think, which is that the United States is fundamentally racist or sexist. The third divisive concept is that an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously. It goes on. Number four is an individual should be discriminated against or receive adverse treatment solely or partly because of his or her race or sex. And then the fifth one is members of one race or sex cannot and should not attempt to treat others without respect to race or sex. Six is an individual's moral character is necessarily determined by his or her race or sex. Number seven is an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, bears responsibility for actions committed in the past by other members of the same race or sex. Number eight is an individual should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other forms of psychological distress on account of his or her race or sex. And then number nine is meritocracy or traits such as hard work ethic are racist or sexist or were created by a particular race to oppress another race.
So a couple of things. I mean, in my mind, some parts of these divisive concepts is already covered maybe by Title VII, you know, that an individual's moral character is determined by sex or race, or that an individual should be discriminated against or receive adverse treatment solely or partly because of race or sex. I mean, based off of the evolution of Title VII, I mean, these kind of what's now being defined as a divisive concept seems to be covered under Title VII. But at the same time, there's some language, I guess, that I'm struggling with specifically within that concept. And it relates directly to kind of training that we may have given in the past or that organizations still may be giving. And that's that it's definition number eight, that any individual should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race or sex. Now, I know that neither you nor I ever attempt to go into a training with the goal of providing psychological distress, but I also know that when we talk about concepts such as implicit bias and best practices and the fact that an individual supervisor or coworker's intention doesn't matter, but the perception of their behavior does, sometimes that can cause some forms of anguish or discomfort or guilt because it was not the intention when I made a dirty joke to make someone feel uncomfortable, but it was their perception. So how would an employer or someone who's providing a training know if part of their training was leading to a feeling of distress, discomfort, guilt, or what might be a divisive concept underneath this executive order?
Well, Tani, that's an excellent question. And I don't think I know the answer to it. And, you know, I think that's something that we as professionals and people that work in the law side of HR and people that work in the HR side of HR need to really think about. I mean, most of these topics, divisive concepts, are covered under Title VII, but then there's a few in here like the United States. You can't say that the United States is a fundamentally racist or sexist country. Things like that. Like, how do we proceed by, you know, teaching what we do without sort of that underlying assumption that we've sort of uncovered in the last couple of decades, which is that they're probably, you know, my perception of the world as a white male is going to be different than your perception of the world as a white female, and it's going to be different than somebody else's perception of the world as a person of color. So, you know, how we go about doing that and complying with this order, it's going to be a challenge for us. And I think that, you know, hopefully by the end of this program, we'll have some thoughts about how we can attack that, how we can address both the systemic issues that we need to address as HR people, trying to build a diverse environment while at the same time not threatening any federal contracts that our employers have.
So there's two other definitions that I think are key to our discussion. One of them is how the executive order defines race or sex stereotyping. How is that defined by the executive order?
It defines race or sex stereotyping as ascribing character traits, values, moral and ethical codes, privileges, status, or beliefs to a race or sex or to an individual because of her race or sex. So it's equivalent of saying, because I'm a man, you can't stereotype me as a man and make assumptions that I am going to, you know, make a pass at somebody because I'm a man, or that I am lecherous because I'm a man. And if you're a woman, you can't say, well, you're going to be overly sensitive to something because you're a woman. That's what they mean by race or sex stereotyping. And that's a pretty familiar concept, I think, for most folks.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think that while we focus less on stereotyping than we may on bias, I think that over the course of the last few decades, there's definitely been significant discussions and a movement away from those type of stereotypes. She's a young woman in her 20s. We can't hire that individual because she'll get pregnant and leave us within, you know, the next couple of years or something. Those race or sex stereotypes are the types of things that we've moved out of, or, you know, have been working, I think, strongly to move out of the work environment. Let's go to like a definition though that would seem to be similar, but slightly different, and I think in terms of the executive order, significantly different. And that's the definition of, it's called race or sex scapegoating. Can you provide our listeners with an understanding as to what that means within the executive order?
Sure. So race or sex stereotyping was assigning certain traits to somebody because of their race or sex, even though they may not even have those traits. And then race or sex scapegoating is assigning fault to somebody or blame to somebody because of their race or sex. So just by virtue of me being a man, I am guilty of creating a hostile work environment in my office. And you, by virtue of being a woman, have created an environment that's unwelcoming to men, or that's, you know, I don't know, whatever. Or you being a white woman has created an environment that's unwelcoming to people of color, for example. That's what they mean by scapegoating in that definition.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today we're talking to Ben Ford, an attorney and partner in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill, and we're discussing the recent White House executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. Now, Ben, within the executive order itself, it notes that scapegoating includes any claim that either consciously or unconsciously an individual, by virtue of their race or sex, are inherently racist or inherently inclined to oppress others. Now, immediately, in my mind, when anyone talks about or makes a note that this is happening consciously or unconsciously, I mean, unconscious bias comes to mind and pops up. In your opinion, is this executive order limiting the ability for any organization to perform implicit bias training? And I know that I've given you a very specific, like, none, any, all those words that attorneys hate. And I probably know what answer I'm going to get, but is implicit bias training inappropriate at this point in time?
I think that it is risky. I'm not going to say that we shouldn't be doing it, but I think that we need to address some of the concepts that we address in implicit bias training and make sure they don't come across this way. I mean, I think implicit bias training is at its core really almost describing a biological process of how the brain works. And I don't think that implicit bias training is necessarily going to assign blame, nor should it assign blame or make people feel guilty. It should just get people to realize that their brains make shortcuts, and let's make people aware of the shortcuts that they're making. And when it's done badly, yeah, you can probably cross the line here for what this executive order is attempting to prohibit. But frankly, if it's done badly, it shouldn't have been done in the first place. And so, yes, I mean, I think this executive order is jarring, but at the same time, if we comply with this executive order by doing implicit bias training the right way, then we shouldn't have a problem with this, and we can get around that. So it really is the difference between explaining a natural phenomena, something that's been proven over and over again since the 60s, and explaining it as a natural phenomena as opposed to a character flaw.
And I think that there's a ton of ways in which good trainers can make sure that the framing of their training fits within this executive order. And I think when we're talking about implicit bias training, talking about the fact that there's multiple studies and lots of research that talks about in-group implicit bias and the fact that you can be implicitly biased against somebody who falls within all of the same categories of protection as yourself. So, you know, a bisexual Latina woman can have implicit biases against other individuals who are bisexual, against other women, against other Latin individuals, so that you have these different characteristics that it doesn't matter what your characteristic is or what group you belong to, but that bias is still going to be there without regard to kind of some of your background characteristics.
Right. And also, you know, the scapegoating definition that they use in the executive order really talks about, you know, racist or inherently inclined to oppress others. And I think when we talk about implicit bias, what we're really talking about is what are the shortcuts your mind makes, and then how do those shortcuts affect your decision-making? And I think there's a long way between affecting decision-making and actually oppressing people. So, you know, while this sounds like we're prohibiting, the executive order prohibits discussions of implicit bias, I think that so long as you're inside of the line of talking about racism and oppression, you're probably going to be okay.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
HR Power Hour is proud to share the following information. Strategic HR 2020 moves from the Mount Washington stage to your living room this October.
Take a virtual journey around the country and witness HR leaders aspiring to greatness in challenging times and earn SHRM and HRCI continuing education credit.
Rates are in effect at strategichrus.com.
Then on October 21st, pour yourself some morning coffee and log on to 3 days of HR exploration.
That's at strategichrus.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Ben Ford, partner in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. And today we're discussing the recent White House executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. Ben, we've spent the first part of the show really focusing in on definitions. And, you know, as lawyers, I know sometimes we spend a ton of time on those details, but let's focus more broadly on the restrictions that are put in place through the executive order. You and I have talked about training generally, and who it applies to, you know, government entities, agencies, and their contractors. But let's talk about, are there other restrictions that are in place as a result of this executive order?
Yeah, I mean, so the executive order says, you know, you shouldn't engage in this, you know, divisive conduct. But when it really gets down to its real meaning, what it is a prohibition on certain things, but also a requirement that companies take certain positions. And so, for example, it says all government contracting agencies shall include in every government contract hereafter the following provisions. During the performance of this contract, the contractor agrees as follows. And then there's a series of different things. For example, the contractor shall not use any workplace training that inculcates in its employees any form of race or sex stereotyping or any form of race or sex scapegoating, including the concepts that an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, bears responsibility for the actions committed in the past by other members of the same race or sex. So basically what it says is that we're going to take the concepts that we're prohibiting and we're going to make that our federal contractors from here on out agree that they're not going to do these things in their workplaces. That first one was talking about scapegoating. And then there's other notices that they're going to have that they're going to do, that they're going to require their federal contractors to do, such as send to each labor union or representative of workers a notice that's going to be provided by the agency's contracting officer advising of the contractor's commitment under the executive order. So not only is a contractor prohibited in engaging in this behavior, but also the labor unions doing work for the contractor are also included. And then finally, the subcontractors are also included. So if you're doing machine work for an arms manufacturer as a subcontractor, then you also are prohibited from engaging in this type of behavior.
And this comes down to something that you and I talk a lot to clients and potential clients about, and that's the importance in this day and age of communication between your HR leaders and your operations leaders. And it's not just with regard to their needs, the organization's needs from a hiring or firing perspective, but specifically language that is included in contracts that may be entered into. Now, the executive order itself sets forth that contracts, so all subcontracts, and this is an and, it's not or, and purchase orders. So any purchase orders have to include these obligations in them. So you're looking at changes of your contract language, of your purchase order forms. All of these must be changed kind of to include and to recognize the obligations that are set forth within this provision. Now, at the same time, a lot of this would seem, okay, Title VII already provides these protections and ramifications, but I think when we put this executive order into context, it becomes even more interesting. It comes on the heels of some exposés regarding different types of trainings that were occurring within the federal government that we're using race stereotyping, talking about white privileges and different aspects related to our history as a country. But specifically what we've seen in response to the Black Lives Matter movement is a multitude of companies across the country who have doubled down on their commitment to hiring Black employees and individuals of color. So in response to that, we've been seeing these training programs that are coming into organization. We've seen these increased commitments, but then we're also seeing this executive order. And simultaneously, we're seeing the Department of Labor, specifically the OFCCP, sending out letters to a multitude of organizations indicating that commitments to hiring people of color or Black employees may be specifically in violation of Title VII. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that we're seeing all of this happen at the same time. Ben, do you have thoughts on what's going on here, if we're seeing a shift away from you know, some Title VII protections, or if we're moving stronger down to more protections in place as a result of race or sex?
Yeah, I also don't think it's a coincidence that this is happening in an election year. And so, unfortunately, I think a lot of the pushback from the government on these programs are really politically motivated, unfortunately. Diversity programs have always been sort of politically hot potatoes, but the reality is that we need diversity in the workforce. If you're a company and you sell to everybody in the United States any kind of widget, you want to have people in your company that reflect the marketplace. If you're a law firm, for example, and you're dealing with businesses that are dealing with issues like this, for example, you need to have lawyers from different backgrounds. This is not we're favoring one race or another over another. We are making an intelligent marketing and business decision to have people in here that have certain characteristics that come from certain backgrounds because they identify better with our market, or they identify better with our clients, or we can come up with better solutions if we have people in our company from a diverse set of backgrounds. So the way you maybe look at this is, I think you're referencing there's a letter or a blog that Microsoft put out in response to one of these OFCCP letters. And so, yeah, if you're a large employer and you got one of these letters, that's something you need to deal with. But the number one thing that I would be concerned about, first off, is Title VII, because if you're discriminating against people and you're creating an environment that's hostile to people of different backgrounds, you're going to have immediate legal problems that's going to start at your state human rights agency right then and there. You're not going to worry about what the federal government's doing and whether or not you're going to get a letter from the Department of Labor. You're going to be dealing with a discrimination claim on your desk that came from a lawyer somewhere, down the street. And so I really do think that the immediate need right now is to stay the course with respect to what you've been doing as far as diversity training, and also with respect to what you've been doing as far as affirmative action type of programs.
Similarly, I mean, you and I have focused a lot of this discussion on outside trainers coming in, whether or not they be HR consultants or their attorneys, focusing in on either diversity training, implicit bias training, anti-discrimination training. I mean, arguably, the terms within this executive order would lead to an internal HR department's trainings or resource building for their own internal supervisors regarding best practices as to interviewing applicants or otherwise onboarding individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think that all of those programs will need to be addressed. I also think that it raises the stakes for, especially if you're a federal contractor, it raises the stakes for who you're bringing in to provide this type of training. And I think you're going to have to be really careful and make sure that the people that you're bringing in to provide this training are qualified to do so. Maybe it's not the person that you saw that gave a really great TED talk. Maybe it's somebody that's got some qualifications, that's aware of this executive order and is versed in how to provide trainings that don't violate the executive order.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
HR Power Hour is proud to share the following information. Strategic HR 2020 moves from the Mount Washington stage to your living room this October.
Take a virtual journey around the country and witness HR leaders aspiring to greatness in challenging times and earn SHRM and HRCI continuing education credit.
Rates are in effect at strategichrus.com.
Then on October 21st, pour yourself some morning coffee and log on to 3 days of HR exploration.
That's at strategichrus.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Ben Ford, attorney and partner in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Verrill. Today we've been discussing the White House executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. We've gone through the order itself, the definition section, how it's different from Title VII, the expansive nature of it as it applies to outside trainers, HR consultants, attorneys, and also internally to your organization and any trainings that your HR department may give to other members of your team. It's great to know what the rules are, Ben, but in weighing any risk, I think you and I both know that understanding the ramifications of noncompliance is important. So is it just a slap on the wrist if you don't do this right? Is it $1 million fine? What are we looking at if you don't follow this executive order?
Well, if you're a federal contractor, you're looking at your federal contracts being canceled. A lot of federal contractors only do business with the federal government. I have clients where the federal government, specifically the Department of Defense, is half of their revenue. And so what you're really talking about is being cut off. Essentially, this could be a firm ending proposition for a lot of companies out there. And it's really interesting to see, you know, normally when an HR department messes up, there might be a lawsuit and maybe there's a settlement from the lawsuit. But in this particular situation where the HR department messes up, it's curtains for the entire business. And I wouldn't want to be the vice president of HR who was responsible for closing down the company. I say that a little bit tongue in cheek because I think there's going to be plenty of warnings and ways to argue around this stuff. But, you know, in terms of managing risk, yeah, this is a big deal. And not only that, it's also, you know, how does the federal government find out about these types of programs? And the Department of Labor is basically setting up a hotline where people can drop a dime on the company and say, listen, I was in this HR sensitivity training and, you know, somebody made me feel guilty about being a white person. And suddenly you've got a Department of Labor investigation on your hands, and that's just not something that you really want to deal with.
And I think to even make, I don't want to say matters worse, but we're talking about multiple agencies. I mean, anyone who works in HR knows that it's an alphabet soup of who they are getting guidance from or what rules and regulations they're following, whether it's OSHA, whether it's the ADA, whether it's the EOC laws, whether it's OFCCP rules and regulations. There's language within this executive order that notes that it won't just be the Department of Labor and the OFCCP that could be knocking on your door, but also the EEOC reviewing potential violations of Title VII. Is that correct, Ben?
Yep, that's exactly right. So the EEOC could jump in here and say you've got a Title VII violation. I see that as being probably a more egregious case. But yeah, I mean, that's always a possibility. So you really have a full-throated government warning, not even a shot across the bow. This is just like, it's pointed right at you. And this is something that you really need to pay attention to. And now the risks associated with providing the training have gone up. There's still a risk associated though with not providing the training that's still there. So you're really kind of, you're kind of in a pickle at this point.
Ben, I always very much appreciate our discussions, and I appreciate you being a guest on today's show and educating all of us a little bit more on this recent executive order and what it means to HR departments moving forward.
Tani, it's great to be here, and I always love talking about the developing area of the law, and I always love the fact that our clients are listening, and I look forward to always hearing messages from people who've heard the program, who have further questions. I hope they don't hesitate to reach out to us.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, this is Tani Alvarez at Verrill. Has your company recently audited its risk for joint employment liability? Do you use a third-party vendor for temporary work or otherwise use contract labor? Have you recently assessed whether you are using best practices to decrease possible liability as to joint employment status? Things that should be considered in this analysis include the interrelationship between operations of the two entities, whether there's common ownership and financial control of the two entities, whether the two entities have common management, and whether there are centralized labor relations or centralized personnel. While each state has individualized standards to determine joint employment, these factors serve as a basis of many of those tests. To further assess your risk of joint employment, talk to a member of Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.